RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So on Friday, the Waitangi Tribunal called for Treaty Principles Bill to be abandoned in scathing report. And yesterday morning, we had Takuta Ferris, the MP for Te Tai Tonga, Te Pāti Māori, giving his thoughts on what the Waitangi Tribunal had been saying late last week, along with other things. So we thought we'd talk about this more with Peter Williams, who joins us, former broadcaster and commentator, but that's not true. He's actually absolutely a current broadcaster and commentator. Peter, it's good to have you back on RCR again. Thank you for coming on this morning.
Pleasure, Paul. And I understand I'm going to be doing a little bit of filling in for Mr. Hyde sometime over the next few weeks as well. So, yes, I suppose I make occasional guest appearances.
Yeah, guest appearances. Okay. You've written a Substack, and I want to sort of kind of go through this. Waitangi Tribunal report predictable. Yeah, predictable, right? It was predictable.
Well, the Waitangi Tribunal has, to my knowledge, never ever come down against a Maori claim or against Maori interests. It seems very well stacked. In fact, it's probably been only once in its history when a report has been written by the Waitangi Tribunal which goes against a Maori claim, and that was when Dr. Michael Bassett was a member of the Waitangi Tribunal back from in the mid-1990s to about 2004. And Dr. Bassett took his history training and his knowledge of history of a particular claim and his ability to research the history of a claim, he took that to his final report and decided that no, there should not be advantage for Maori through that particular claim. I don't know the exact details of it. I understand it was something to do with kiwi fruit in the Bay of Plenty. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the then boss of the Waitangi Tribunal was, shall we say, not pleased with Dr. Bassett's response. So he duly left the tribunal around about 2004. And ever since then, it's been pretty much one-way traffic.
We had Takuta Ferris on, as I mentioned. And one thing that I got from that I didn't get first up is the perception that is out there. I had a simplistic view I wouldn't call it one-sided, but a particular view of what that treaty was. But listening to him, he's basically saying that there was a sovereign entity existing before the British came along, and the treaty or the deal made between Maori and the Crown consisted of two kind of equal sovereign entities under the Confederation of Chiefs, I think he said, and that is the starting point of this treaty, this deal that that we've all sort of been living by since, which was quite divergent from my concept, which was a lot more simplistic, you know?
Well, I just find that quite extraordinary. The reality is there was no sovereign nation. There was a landmass which had been discovered, settled in by navigators from Polynesia sometime around the year 1250. The first European to clap eyes on the place, as we know, was Abel Tasman in 1642, didn't come ashore. Captain James Cook arrived in 1769, and after that, various whalers, settlers, missionary, etc. In the meantime, there was a population on these lands that was at very best disparate. There was no sovereign nation. That's just arrant nonsense. There were tribes, iwi, who were living quite independently. This is according to all the history that I have read. There was very little interconnectedness, certainly not a lot of goodwill between those iwi, hence the constant tribal warfare that went on, which reached its apogee really in the early 19th century, in the years between 1805 and about 1839, because the British, the European settlers, had brought the muskets, had brought gunpowder, and there was much fighting between various iwi, and the winners were invariably the ones who had the most guns, muskets. So yeah, to say that this was a sovereign nation is crazy. Sure, there was the Confederation of Chiefs, who were part of the signing of the treaty on the 6th of February 1840, but there were also many iwi chiefs who were not part of that confederation, because it says in the document, this is between Her Majesty Queen Victoria and the Confederation of Chiefs and other chiefs and leaders of sub-tribes. So to say that there was a nation here is just silly, and I think is stretching the truth, and just yet another example of the modern-day interpretation, modern-day reading of the treaty, which is there in black and white for all to see.
Another thing that Tekuta made the point of was the difference in language between the Maori version and the English version of the treaty, and kind of the two things say different things.
Yeah. Well, that's been well established now for the best part of 50 years, I guess, that particular attitude. One of the biggest things we've got to remember is that the administration of this treaty, the signing of the treaty, was shoddy. And that's putting it nice. The treaty was written by Busby and by Hobson. It was then translated by Williams, father and son, William and Henry, who then put it to the iwi chiefs who signed it, some of them reluctantly, some of them, many of them, in fact, weren't going to sign it until there was a discussion between them. Many of the notes, the discussions were recorded and are in the archives. The book One Sun in the Sky is a very good reference for some of the discussions that happened both on the 5th of February and indeed in the days just after the signing at Waitangi as the parchment went around the country. But the problem was that the original version of the treaty, as I understand it, which was written by Busby, got lost. And this is an example of, as I say, the shoddy administration of it. Hobson's secretary by the name of James Freeman copied it. There were translations and back translations, and in essence, all sorts of subtle meanings, subtle nuances were lost and not necessarily cross-referenced. In other words, and we've got to remember that in 1840, Te Reo, the Maori language, was not really that well developed as a written language. So there were always going to be issues with the translation. So the words Kawanatonga, for instance, what does that mean? The British thought it meant sovereignty. The chiefs in later years decided it meant governorship or government. In effect, it's the same thing because it's the same outcome. But Maori, of course, trace their modern interpretation, that being we did not cede sovereignty, to this word Kawanatonga, which says that is not ceding of sovereignty, that is possibly ceding governorship. So again, it's the nuances, the subtleties, and the fact that we have two at times vastly varying interpretations of what the treaty not just says, but what it means. In many respects, it leads us to believe that 184 years later, is there really a place for the Treaty of Waitangi in modern New Zealand constitutional arrangements? Wouldn't it be much nicer if we could just have one set of rules, black and white, for everyone, taking into account a bit of history, taking into account everybody's place in our society? But the constant to-ing and fro-ing, the interpretation of the treaty as it was in 1840, as it was at the Koemarama Conference in 1860, as what Siraparana Nata said at the centenary of the treaty in 1940, then since the Treaty of Waitangi Act in 1975 and the constant interpretation since, it is just a very, very complicated mess now, one which really can only be settled by either some definitive legislation one way or the other, or by doing away with the treaty completely. And I'm, as of now, in two minds as to which I prefer.
Messy, I think, is the word. So this revisionist creep along the way, you've been around for a while. When do you think that really started to kick in?
Oh, it started in 1975 with the with the installation of the Treaty of Waitangi Act. Up until then, you know, I was born in 1954, so the first 20 years of my life, the Treaty of Waitangi was, it was something that was there. It was something that had been signed, but it didn't actually mean a hell of a lot. It certainly wasn't in our law, wasn't in our constitution. In the late 1960s, early 70s, there was a few rumblings of Maori activism. Ngā Tamatoa at Auckland University was, I guess, the first sign of that. Matt Rata, being a strong Maori nationalist, remember he left the Labour Party to form a party called Mana Motuhake in the late 1970s, but he was in the Norman Kirk government, the third Labour government of 1972 to 1975. He was the Minister of Maori Affairs, and he pushed the case for the Treaty of Waitangi to be incorporated into New Zealand legislation, hence the Treaty of Waitangi Act, which was passed in 1975. But it was all about righting the wrongs of land that had been confiscated. And there would be claims put to this Waitangi tribunal, claims originally, you might remember, that could only be made about acts of theft or land confiscation, only going back to 1975. That was the original legislation. There was also inserted into that act this phrase, which has caused all sorts of problems in the last 50 years, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. The phrase was inserted in the legislation, but was never defined, which is just, it's mind-boggling when you think about it, and that's why David Seymour at last is trying to do something about it. Anyway, 1975, the Act was passed. It was amended during the term of the next Labour government in 1986, and that time for claims against land confiscation or the taking of Maori land was amended back to 1840. So then we had the claims flooding in. They flooded in so much that Helen Clark, when she was in power, stopped the claims or said they all had to be lodged by 2008. And indeed they have been. And the Waitangi Tribunal then had the job of settling those claims, holding the hearings, getting the evidence, and settling the claims. And mostly, they've done a very good job. The sums of money involved are frankly quite piffling when you think about it. I think there's only about $4 billion been paid out over the time of the claims, and they began not, well, the payouts didn't begin until the mid-1990s, did they, with Ngāi Tahu and Tainui, those two big settlements. And of course, there's always been the proportionality claims along the way as well. But the only big one that hasn't been settled is Ngāpuhi. And I find that quite extraordinary. But then that's all about, it's not because of a lack of willingness on the part of the Crown. It's because of Ngāpuhi not being able to, frankly, sort things out amongst themselves as to who is eligible to do the claiming. And I think in the end, that particular claim will be broken up into various sub-iwi, possibly even hapu, and there'll be a series of smaller claims settled up there, because if no government and no treaty negotiations minister has ever been able to settle that claim in the 25 years or so that they've been trying, and we're talking about people like Doug Graham and Chris Finlayson and famously Andrew Little, who did get very angry with Ngāpuhi at one of the early meetings that he had. If they can't do that, then frankly, it's never going to be settled at a large scale level. So I think it's going to be a series of subclaims that that will in the end sort out what money goes the way of the Ngāpuhi people. So I was just saying that once the claims are settled, the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal, the Waitangi Tribunal, was effectively out of business.
Yeah.
So then they didn't want that to happen because that would mean a loss of power. So
turkeys don't vote for Christmas.
So yeah, precisely. The Waitangi Tribunal has effectively gone looking for other work. And as a consequence, they've looked around for various issues and found people to put in claims against the government, which they can have heard through the Waitangi Tribunal, the latest of which is this proposed treaty principles bill that David Seymour and the ACT Party are leading. The bizarre thing about this particular report that came out last Friday. They had a couple of days of hearings, about it in May, but the principal's bill has not even been drafted yet. All they're doing is holding, what they've done is hold hearings and issued a 200-page report or thereabouts on press releases, essentially, which is, it's quite extraordinary when you think about it. But they've got to find a way to justify their existence, and they certainly have and come out absolutely swinging. So they've become a very political body, and that's what I've written about in my Substack piece of last week. So it's become a very political body, which is aimed to fire some shots across the bow of the ACT Party, across the bow of the coalition government, and they actually know full well that in the National Party and in Christopher Luxon, they've got somebody who, frankly, has got no spine at all and will probably just go and crawl up and sit on a seat in the corner and face the wall, because he has got no belly for a discussion, no belly for any kind of involvement, of connection on this matter. And more's the pity, really. He is showing an absolute lack of leadership and frankly, a limpness, which I think is distressing as far as New Zealanders are concerned.
He doesn't want a confrontation, does he, really?
No,
he doesn't want any sort of confrontation at all. Fight,
not just on this, but on numerous other matters you might have noticed as well.
The wider judiciary has also embraced this creep as well, hasn't it? I mean, we saw Tikanga coming into the Ellis case, and that seems to have worked its way in as well.
Yeah, the Edwards case regarding Takatai Moana, the Maka case with the Eastern Bay of Plenty, foreshore and seabed, Tikanga has been brought into that as well. And now they want to teach Tikanga in law schools.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't actually know what Tikanga is. Tikanga is different things to different people. And it's like the Treaty of Waitangi principles at the moment. They are different things to different people. It means that you've got way, way, way too much fluidity in our constitution and in our legislation and our legal system. And you've got to have more certainty than that if you're going to be a properly functioning society, don't you?
Yeah, where do you think it all heads? Because I'm looking at the three clauses that
Seymour's put up. Yeah,
Seymour wants in there, and I kind of said no one can argue with any of that. It's so. Well,
the problem is they can.
No, but they shouldn't. Then I mean, it's so reasonable.
But the very first one that Seymour's put up, which is the New Zealand government has the right to govern New Zealand on behalf of all New Zealanders.
Yes.
This,
hello.
This Waitangi Tribunal report said, well, no, that's not right, because we didn't cede in sovereignty. So therefore the government does not have the right to govern all New Zealanders. So in actual fact, the Waitangi Tribunal is challenging the legitimacy of the New Zealand government 184 years on from the signing of the treaty. I mean, it's absurd, because if the New Zealand government is not legitimate, then the Waitangi Tribunal is not legitimate. And none
Good
of those
point.
Claims over the last 35 years can be legitimate, because they were all settled under an act of a parliament that the Waitangi Tribunal in this report seems to think doesn't have a right to exist. Go figure.
Yeah, that sort of nulls everything, doesn't it?
It does.
Do you think they thought of that?
Yeah. Well,
has it occurred
to them?
I don't
think they thought of it. They're just on the gravy train.
Okay. Maybe we'll go through the other. Yeah.
I just find their attitude to principle number one absurd. Principle number two, frankly, is a bit trickier. That comes down to the poor administration, the shoddy translating, back-translating the writing out of the treaty in English, the writing of the treaty in Te Reo back in 1840. You remember, of course, that the Busby, the original Busby treaty, which is, again, subtly different from what is an appendix in the 1975 Act, that was lost until it was discovered in 1989, but it's now been essentially dismissed, even though it has the handwriting of Busby and a watermark which suggests that it was in fact written on the 4th of February 1840, and it is the absolute original English version of the treaty. The one which is appendicized to the Treaty of Waitangi Act is one of the Freeman copies, the Freeman back translations, which has a few subtle differences, particularly in Article 2, about lands and forests and fisheries and taonga and the like. And there are, again, you know, arguments over what Article 2 actually said. The other key phrase in Article 2 is that the government, there is the phrase, all New Zealanders. Now, the Waitangi Tribunal has now decided that all New Zealanders in the context of 1840 only meant Maori New Zealanders, even though there were approximately, I understand, 2,000 non-Maori, 2,000 British settlers, whalers, missionaries living here at the time. So they apparently did not count as New Zealanders in the context of that treaty written in 1840. So the Waitangi Tribunal has challenged that, and I can sort of see where they're coming from there. So that does cause problems. But David Seymour, remember, is not rewriting the treaty. He's trying to write some principles of the treaty. And he's trying to come up with a principle which equates to what Article 2 said. And the point is that in 2024, Maori constitute, Maori, part Maori, those with some Maori heritage constitute, what, about 20% of the population? Maybe more. It's never been completely and thoroughly and utterly defined, because we've got to ask the basic question, what is a Maori?
What is a woman? What is a Maori?
Yeah. What is a Maori with 1/200? Do you have, if you've got 1/256th of your bloodline, does that count? If you have 1/512th, 1/1024th, I mean, if you can trace it back six or seven generations, then why shouldn't you be regarded as a Maori? But there is a very circular definition in the Treaty of Waitangi Act, which I think is just totally bizarre. You know, it says, it tries to define what a Maori is, and it says a Maori is a member of the Maori race. I mean, what the hell?
A bit loose.
Yeah, you think?
Yes, I do.
So you've got real definition issues here. So what Seymour is trying to say, that in 2024 in New Zealand, we should just all be New Zealanders, and that if we own property, if we own land, we should have the right of ownership, governorship, chieftainship, whatever you want to call it, over that land, over that property. And what could be so wrong with that? If people own land, it means that you can effectively do what you want to do on that land without outside influence, without undue outside influence telling you what you can and cannot do on that land within the confines of the law as it stands. And Seymour here is absolutely taking a pot shot at farmers who find that they've got 50, 60, 70% of their land, which has now been designated as an SNA or Waitapu or ONL, the Outstanding Natural Landscapes, and they are unable to do any work on that land. They're unable to change the land use. They're unable to put up a fence. They're unable to put up a barn shed unless they get consent from an outside body, even though they might have owned that land for 150 years through various generations of the family. So Seymour's saying that if you own land, you should have within the rights of, within the bounds of resource management legislation, you should have the right to effectively do what you want to do your business on that piece of land. And I can't see what the problem is, but we know that there has developed in recent times a huge industry in getting Maori cultural reports on land. So you might own a farm and there has been a piece of land that has been designated on that land as being wahi tapu or of significant, having cultural significance, you have to get, at quite an expense, the local iwi to write a cultural report before you can get a consent from the local council to do whatever development you want to do on it. So I think the old term for it is rent seeking. So Seymour effectively wants to bring an end to that kind of activity. And herein lies the issue, because it's a major source of revenue for various iwi. And it's in many respects, it's it's not quite blackmail, but it's bloody close to it. I mean, look what's happened on the Waitaki River in recent times. The Waitaki River's got, 50% of the country's hydro storage. It's got dams down the lower end at the Lower Waitaki Dam, Aviemore and Benmore. Further up, you've got the Tekapo schemes, the Tekapo power scheme. What is it, Meridian and what's the other company there? Maybe Genesis have paid, is it $100 million to Ngāi Tahu?
Wow.
For basically just to make them go away so that they can get their consents to keep on generating power for the next 35 years. I mean, that is, frankly, it's nothing short of extortion. And it became a problem which was obviously way too hard for the big brains that are on the boards of directors and upper management at those power companies. So they just paid up, and it's disgraceful. Absolutely.
Well, with money like that, it's not
our power prices.
With money like that, it's no wonder to follow the money in the end, isn't it?
And that's essentially what it's all about. And that's why members of the Waitaki Tribunal, they see these opportunities for cultural reports, for bribes that have got to be paid to allow consents. If you give iwi through the second principle, if that second principle that David Seymour's punting, if that doesn't happen, Article 2, iwi will keep on saying, well, Article 2 says we've got rangatiratanga and we're going to ensure that we have control and that you can't do anything on a particular piece of land or a particular waterway unless we say so. And the best way for us to say so is if you give us some money.
Yeah, and it goes away. The problem goes away.
It does. Miraculously, the problem
that Vivian
and Genesis had went away when they paid $100 million.
It seems it's an arm wrestle between equality of opportunity, equality of outcome. Here's something from your Substack that jumped out on me. You say, here's a revelation. The world does not provide equitable outcomes. A country like New Zealand, with its democratic government, provides equality of opportunity. Equitable outcomes could never be guaranteed. People got to get their head around that, don't they?
Well, I would have thought it was utterly self-evident.
But it's obviously not.
I've known that, Paul. I've understood that all my life, haven't you?
Yeah, same. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, people have forgotten it or something.
I mean, heaven forbid, in our game, we knew that when we joined Radio New Zealand or NZBC, announced a training scheme, we knew that there were some people who were better than us. It just sort of happened.
Yeah.
But we had the opportunity to get better through the training scheme. I mean, that's one little piddly example, I suppose. But everybody has the opportunity to get a free education. Everybody has the opportunity to go to the doctor at a reasonable price, if they can get in.
Everybody
has the opportunity to get government paid for dental care up to the age of 18. Everybody has the opportunity to go on to higher education, albeit at a price, but there are student loan schemes. I mean, what I'm saying is that there is opportunity in this country still for everybody if you are prepared to get off your backside and take advantage of that opportunity.
Last question, Peter, your thoughts. You're very knowledgeable and you've been around for a while. As I said before, I don't want to keep reminding you of that, by the way. Can this rip us apart? I think it has the potential to, if someone or something, like you're saying before, with the kahunas, that's the word, to come in and kind of start drawing a line in some way under this constant revising, churning over the past, trying to reconcile contradictory interpretations of things endlessly. Where do we end up?
I don't know. I really don't know. And what I'm finding really disturbing is that there are the early signs of some violence in this issue. We've had the example already, haven't we, of the New Plymouth District Councillor Murray Chong having a shot fired at his car. We've had that outrageous behaviour by the Maori Ward Councillor in Kaipara, where she just has no ability to discuss anything rationally. The only way to protest in her mind is to open the door, let people come in and make a lot of noise. I mean, apart from anything, it's just appallingly bad manners. But let's have some rational discussion about these things. Instead of just reverting to ad hominem attacks, instead of just saying everything that is not in favour of Waitangi Tribunal decisions, stop calling everybody racist, basically. That's just a cheap and, frankly, not very intelligent way of arguing the matter. Let's come back to a basic premise. This land is called New Zealand. We are New Zealanders. Let's all live together as New Zealanders. As David Seymour says, and I've quoted this in my Substack, no country, no successful nation has ever, ever existed when you've got one class of people defined by race, which has an advantage over another. I guess I'm paraphrasing what Seymour says, but essentially there has been no successful nation on earth which has been had its political opportunities divided by race. Yet there are people in New Zealand who want to do that. And we just have to hope like hell that it doesn't. When you get shots being fired at a district councillor's car, when you have the activities that we saw at the Kaipara District Council the other week, when you see indeed the poster that Te Pāti Māori put up recently with its call to action for a demonstration with the two cocked pistols, you think, really? You hope like hell that some sanity is going to prevail. I would like to see some leadership from Māoridom on the issue from the iwi leadership just to calm things down a bit. I mean, I know that John Key said, let's calm things down a bit, but then he effectively was doing what Luxon's doing. That's going away and folding up in a ball in the corner saying, just run the show. We can't do that. We can't do that. So there has got to be some leadership and some rational discussion about this. Otherwise, the country is headed, I think, for a pretty sad place.
An epic own goal is something we don't want.
Yep.
Peter, thanks for coming on this morning. I look forward to seeing you in our studio next week in for Rodney. But that was really interesting. And if people want to go and read your Substack, it's searchable on Substack and it's under your name, peteralanwilliams.substack.com. We'll see you in the studio next week, Peter. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Nice talking with you.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.